Blog Talk Radio.
Some help, y'all. We want to wake up everybody to MPH Radio. Today's date is the 26th day of February 2022. Our theme today is part two, telling our stories. Freedom is coming. Along with our theme today, we will discuss various segments from giving you something to think about, to Black MPH Black Mini Facts, to a message from the community. But more important today, we have a very important story that must be told for all African people around the world and those who love humanity. And that story that must be told today is the story of the history and the struggle of Haiti. And we have invited Brother Kwaku Lumumba, who will tell that story. So we want to make sure that you get everybody around the table at this point in time and tell them to listen in, because we're going to tell our stories today. I'm your host, the voice of MPH Radio, and we're going to get started at this point in time. But first and foremost, we want to give you something to think about. That's right, give you something to think about, and that thing is this concept that we call freedom. Freedom is a concept in which many people have fought over, died over, and continue to die over. And it become important for all people to understand what is this concept of freedom and what are you willing to do to achieve it. So we're going to give you two concepts that we're going to repeat earlier in one of our programs around two concepts of freedom that was related by our freedom thinkers, Brother Arthur of Schomburg. When he talked about freedom, he gave us his definition of freedom as being study the people who took you out of history. Then you understand your history. Think about that. Study the people who took you out of history, then you will understand your history. Another concept of freedom is from Dr. John Henry Clark. He once stated, for your survival, draw on the intellectual heritage of the whole world, but always start with your own intellectual heritage. That's a statement from Brother John Clark. Now, based upon no concept of freedom, maybe we could use those concepts in our daily lives to make us a better person and help push our people forward. Those are our two concepts of freedom for today. And at this particular time, we're going to transcend from this segment to our next segment of MPH Black Minifact. We're going to bring in Susie at MPH, and she can share with you a minifact dealing with the history and the legacy of Brother Malcolm X. He left a profound statement in which we want to remind everyone not to forget one of his lessons. So, Susie, we will now welcome you to MPH. Welcome, Susie, to MPH, Mr. Page's History Radio.
Good evening. I'll be giving you a black mini fact, and it's coming from Malcolm X's statement about 70 years ago, the Evergreen Comrade. They mock your names, and you change your name. They made fun of our clothes, and you change your clothes. They made fun of your hair, and you brought air fresheners. They made fun of your skin, and you brought bleach. They mock your tongues, and you adopted theirs. They made fun of your religions, and you embraced theirs. Who taught you to hate your hair texture? Who taught you to hate the color of our skin? So much that you bleach her to be like the white man. Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet? Who taught you to hate your nature? Hating the land of your ancestors, hating the race you belong to, so much you don't want to stand next to each other. When will we wake up? And that's a statement from Malcolm X. It's a black mini fact today, Saturday, February the 26th.
So we'd like to thank you for your black mini fact today. And hope we think about that particular message that was left by our brother Malcolm. At this point in time, when we talk about history, we talk about his and their story. Well, we like to tell our story from our perspective. We would like to make history as a guiding point to direct our people forward and towards. Many times, history is written from perspectives when it comes to African history that we was a historical people. Well, that is their story. That's not ours. What we're going to do right now, we're going to give you a perspective on some ancient African history as it relates to African pharaohs, kingdoms of Kush. This particular presentation can be viewed or can be listened to by going to YouTube, and we encourage all our listening audience to go there and check out the primary sources. But we'll bring this to you today as honor and a continuation of our ongoing learning of African history. For African History Month. Let's listen in.
The ancient Egyptians built one of the greatest empires in history, and, despite facing many difficulties, managed to maintain their sovereignty over almost the entire Nile River Valley. But Africa has always been a gigantic continent, inhabited by many different peoples. Some wanted to conquer the fertile lands of Egypt. Kingdoms and tribes with origins in Libya, Syria, and Turkey were constantly fighting against Egypt. But there were people whose tenacity and courage frightened even the powerful Egyptians. The Nubians were an African people who lived in the Nubia region in today's Sudan. The Nubian people have been living in that region for a long time. By 3100 BC, there would be Nubian villages along the River Nile. During much of their history, the Nubians did not develop any writing. Much of what we know about them is in the records left by the Egyptians. The Nubia was a region rich in gold veins, semi-precious stones, ebony wood, incense, and ivory. This wide range of resources encouraged the Egyptians to invade that region in search of extremely useful raw materials. The Nubians resisted the Egyptian invasions as much as possible, but they were militarily inferior and were progressively pushed south. Due to the various periods of instability in Egypt, the Nubians were able to organize more effective defenses. During periods of peace, Nubians and Egyptians traded and shared different forms of knowledge. During the reign of Pharaoh Thutmose I, the Nubians were part of the Egyptian Empire, but that dominion quickly collapsed, and the Nubians established a unified kingdom, with Napata as its capital. The Nubians thus founded the Kingdom of Kush, which would become a respected African power. The term Kushite Kingdom comes from the Egyptians, who called the Nubian Kush. The founder of this new kingdom was a tribal leader named Alara, who became king of all the Nubians. With the Kushite kingdom established, the next step was to ensure its defense and economy. For this, Alara's successors reigned successfully, strengthening the kingdom and expanding their domains. The Kushites began to trade with Egypt through the Nile. They also established contact with the Arab kingdoms such as Nabatea and Sheba. The riches of the Kushites were extremely popular. Their leaders, priests, and even farm animals, like horses, were always embellished with pieces of gold and rubies. Over time, and due to the periods of instability in Egypt, the Kushites started to conquer Egyptian cities, including the city of Thebes. At the height of their power, under the command of King Paye, Egypt was fully conquered by the Kushites. King Paye declared himself the champion at the command of the god Amon. He joined his army, warred for over a year against several Egyptians, defeating everyone in his path. The phase of the Kushite and Egyptian history took place during the third intermediate period of ancient Egypt, which began around the year 1070 BC. It is a period also historically known as the Nubian Dynasty. The coexistence between Egyptians and Nubians originated marriages between the nobility of the two kingdoms. Both cultures influenced each other in religious and social matters. After consolidating the dominion in Egypt, King Paye returned to the city of Napata, capital of the Kushite kingdom, leaving his brother and successor to rule Egypt and its cities. Egypt remained under Kushite rule until 656 BC, and only weakened due to the Assyrian invasions, which conquered almost all of Egypt, causing turbulent pharaoh's lands. The Assyrians were fearsome warriors, much superior militarily. They already used iron weapons and armor, besides siege weapons and a well-trained cavalry. The Kushite rulers had to retreat to Napata. Sometime later, they founded the city of Meroe further south. Meroe became the new capital of the Kushite kingdom. The Kushite rulers adopted the Egyptian custom of erecting pyramids, being buried in those built in the city. During this period, the Kushites began to develop their writing, the Meroitic script. The Greek historian Diodorus Siculus claimed that the Kushite kings reigned until they received an order from the priests of the Golden Temple. When this happened, they committed suicide and passed the power to the next sovereign. This strange custom lasted until the reign of the leader Ergamenes, different from most of his compatriots. He was an educated man, having studied with Greek teachers and learned philosophy. When Ergamenes was ordered to commit suicide, he was furious. He sent his soldiers to the temple to kill the priests, putting an end to this custom. Women also had important roles in Kushite society, having an active voice in everyday matters. For several times, Kushite queens reigned without the interference of male companions. There are even reports of Kushite women who fought in battles and commanded troops. The king's mother was given the title of Candace, which means Queen Mother. She was the king and queen's advisor. On some occasions, she participated in political negotiations and could even take full command. One of these powerful women, and perhaps the bravest of her people, was Amani Shaketo, who reigned in Kush when Rome had already conquered Egypt after the defeat of Mark Antony and Cleopatra. Rome demanded that the kingdom of Kush pay tribute to the Republic. Amani Shaketo did not accept this demand and considered it an offense, declaring war against Rome. Her soldiers advanced to pillage Egyptian cities under Roman rule. In 24 BC, the Kushites sacked the cities of Aswan, Philae, and Elephantine. They returned to Kush with prisoners, valuable objects, and Roman statues. Even the head of the statue of the Roman Emperor Augustus was taken by Amani Shaketo in a gesture of contempt against the enemy. Upon learning this, Augustus sent Roman general Petronius and his soldiers to punish the Kushites. There are few details about the battle, but Petronius may have said that the Kushites had more than 30,000 warriors and were fighting with frightening fury. Amani Shaketo was described as a corpulent and rough woman. She led her troops and became blind in one eye and being wounded by a Roman. After more than 3 years of fighting, the Romans finally proposed a peace agreement. In the year 20 BC, Romans and Kushites signed a peace treaty. The Roman Emperor recognized the kingdom of Kush as an independent power without being obliged to pay taxes to Rome. The kingdom of Kush lasted until AD 350, but due to a lack of resources and trade, the kingdom was very weakened and dispersed. The once rich and proud Kushite kingdom ended up dominated by the Aksum Empire, which expanded its borders from the region of Ethiopia. The Kushites were an incredible people, with brave warriors, skilled craftsmen, and wise merchants. Their history shows us the strength and perseverance of the African people, capable of repelling even the powerful Roman Empire.
You're walking back to MPH Radio. You were just given a historical version of African Pharaoh's kingdom of Kush. Your history has a very powerful past. At this point in time, we will go to a station break with music with a message. And when we come back, we will continue telling our stories. And this story that will be told will be the story of the history of Haiti and its struggle. We have special guest, Brother Kwaku Lumumba. Don't you go nowhere. We're going to turn our page, that page, and continue to fill in those other missing pages of history. We'll be right back.
If you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you held your white teacher?
respect your brother's woman friend, and share with black folks not of kin. I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
we'll make a better society. And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right?
Mama, you got us living on the front line. Welcome back to MPH Radio. Yes, if you have any kind of choices, whether they're colors or choices out of life, we're going to make it by using our history as a tool. Yes, we are on the front line, and we continue to battle for our freedom and liberation. Right now, we are dealing with our theme, part two, telling our stories. And we want to let everybody know that freedom is coming. That's our theme for today. And we're going to continue to tell our story, our stories, by bringing in our beloved brother, Kwaku Amumu, who's going to briefly introduce himself. But he's going to tell a story that is very important, not only to Africa and African people, but to all of humanity. When we talk about revolutions that took place, whether in 1917 out of Russia or the French Revolution, many people who wrote that history would like you to believe that that revolution was the most and one of the greatest revolutions that ever took place. But like always, we know that there are many missing pages of history when it comes to our people and our struggle. So today, we hope to make our small contribution by filling in one of those missing pages of history in terms of the great importance of the history of the struggle of Haiti and the Haiti Revolution. And to tell that story to us and the rest of the listening world, we will now bring in our brother Kwaku Lumumba. We would like to welcome you to the MPH. And brother Kwaku, for those who don't know you, tell the people a little something about your background or who you are.
Well, first off, I would like to thank you for inviting me to the program. It's an honor to be here, and it's an honor to be here during African History Month to discuss something that's so important to African people, and not just in the nation of Haiti, but no matter where we happen to live in the world. So I'm honored, and I thank you for that. As you said before, my name is Kwaku Lumumba. I actually have also the honor of serving as external relations coordinator for a socialist organization that is formed and based in Haiti. And that organization is COSA for short, but the long name is Combat Citoyen Socialiste pour Sauver Haiti. That translates roughly into socialist citizens working together to save Haiti. And so, you know, I'm just a brother that really loves my people. I love my African people no matter where we happen to be, and I strongly believe that we need to be united as a people so that we can liberate ourselves from whatever it is that holds us back from our full potential.
Thank you, my brother. Now, when we talk about Haiti and its history and struggle and their revolution, when you tell your story, what would that be, Brother Lumumba? We will give you the mic now and share your story.
You know, it's interesting that you asked me to share my story in relation to the struggle of Haiti and that revolution there that has really impacted the African world. Because in moving to Haiti and living in Haiti, you know, I really got an appreciation for that revolution beyond anything that I could have gotten by reading a book, which I had read books. Or by watching a documentary, which I had also watched documentaries, or even attending lectures from academics, in which I had done that too. But actually being in the space and sharing in that space, sharing the food, sharing the culture, and seeing the history, because a lot of things that have impacted the nation and impacted the African world are still visible there in the culture and visible there in the landscape. So those are things that I could only have gotten by spending time there and patiently learning from the land and learning from the culture in order to really appreciate the impact of the revolution and this ongoing struggle in that nation. And, you know, I encourage every one of us to travel to these kinds of places, even if it's not Haiti. Anywhere that we have some sort of appreciation. Earlier on the program, you did a wonderful job of highlighting a history of ancient Kemet and the Kushites. Well, those places, that land still exists and it's still accessible to us. So I encourage anyone who has a passion for ancient Kemet or ancient Kush or ancient Nubia, so on and so forth, to travel to Sudan, travel to Egypt, travel to Ethiopia, travel to Somalia, and travel to these places and spend time in learning the culture and seeing that impact of those ancient histories on the modern populations, because they're still visible to us. And so in relation to the struggle, though, in IET, in my story, it's one in which a lot of the history that's told about IET is not really one where the average African today can really appreciate it. Even that includes people in IET today, too. Because when we look at, let's say, revolutionary period in IET, 1791 to 1804, which is, you know, usually called the Haitian Revolution, even that period, if we don't look at what happened before that, then we don't really appreciate the successes of that period. And when we are looking at history, for example, and we talk about the era of Christopher Columbus and his arrival to these lands here that people tend to call the Americas, the first place that he arrived was the island currently known as IET. And it was also known as IET back then because IET is an indigenous name for the space. So when he arrives there, it kicks off this dispute over land between who he claims the land should belong to, the Spanish crown, and who it already was under the dominion of, the indigenous peoples of the land, who already had their own governance structure. They had their own ways of maintaining the land and dealing with one another. And so that is really the start of what we call the struggle against oppression and enslavement and colonization. And it involved these people that continued this push along with the Africans who were brought over as political prisoners within the next 10 years or so, until the point of successful independence and liberation from that system in 1804. So we're really looking at a period of about three centuries of struggle before we arrive at the victory that we all celebrate in 1804, which led to the independent empire of liberty, which was called IET. So that's one of the first lessons that Haiti, the history of Haiti, and the history of the Haitian Revolution really teaches us as African people in struggle, that we may want to see everything change overnight, but we have to be committed to a long-term struggle, a generational struggle. And we have to be prepared to pass on this struggle to those who can succeed us. Because, you know, one elder, Bilal Sunni Ali, I hear him often say that we measure our success by our successors. So no matter how great we may be in our lifetimes, if we have no one to succeed us, then our success is really inconsequential. Malcolm X was quoted earlier in the program, and beautifully so. Malcolm X has countless successors. So the level of his success, even though his life was cut down short before he saw 40 years old, and even though the organizations that he created were thwarted by state apparatus, the virtue of people being able to look to Malcolm X as an inspiration and transform their own lives so that they can be an asset to their communities is the legacy of Malcolm X, the true legacy of Malcolm X, that today in 2022, we can still talk about Malcolm X and people can still be inspired to organize in his name. So his success is, it really can't be quantified because he has so many successors. And we see the same thing happen in the history of IET. There are many revolutionaries that have come about over the period of those 300 years. Many of them were assassinated. Many of them, we don't even know their names, but they had successors, people who picked up the torch after they were killed and continued the struggle until its successful end in 1804. If we can look at a few names. For example, Macandal. Macandal is a famous figure in IET because he preceded this 1791 to 1804 period of revolution. And he fomented revolution on the countryside. And he, you know, really what we would recognize today as guerrilla warfare, where in the bush was his headquarters, and he was able to liberate people and have them headquartered there and he was a master of botany, so he understood the landscape and how to use plants and animals both for healing and for harm, so that he would be able to heal Africans, heal indigenous people who were enslaved and dealing with a life expectancy of no longer than 10 years because of the brutality of the enslavement system there. And then also use those same skills and knowledge to harm the slave masters, to harm the colonizers, to harm the invaders. And until his demise, when he was finally caught and assassinated. But he, like another icon, Marcus Garvey, who when he was caught and when he met his demise, he talked about the whirlwind and how his cubs would come back and be able to continue the struggle that he started. Well, Makanda in the 1700s did the same thing. And he, when he was caught, he talked about coming back in a swarm of mosquitoes. And we saw that happen, in which in the revolutionary struggle of 1791 to 1804, one of the things, one of the natural phenomena that aided the Africans in their struggle against the European colonizers was mosquitoes and diseases that these Europeans could not manage against, caused by mosquitoes. And so we see the succession of struggle even going down to a natural level, something that we don't often talk about, understanding our environment and able to use our environment to our benefit in struggle, not just being passively involved in an environment and allowing our enemies to use it against us. So when we see these other people, let's move on to a Bookman Dutty, who wasn't born in Haiti. In fact, he was brought over to Haiti from Jamaica. And he, at first, was not the revolutionary that we know him for, but he was revolutionized. He was politicized to join the revolution. And so these are the kind of icons that we can look to and say, you know what? Even if my brother or my sister or my son or my daughter or even my father or my mother are not revolutionaries today, as long as they live, we can have impact through these kind of conversations, through organizations, through our consistent struggle on our brothers and sisters, our families, our communities, so that they can see the reality and the need of joining in struggle. And then they can become the revolutionaries that we need. Just like Bookman, who after sparking or inspiring the soldiers, the revolutionaries, in what we call the Congress of Wakaima, which was the ceremony of 1791 that happened all across the nation. It wasn't just one event or one point in the geography that led to the 1791 phase of the revolution. It was something that was organized over time so that people could organize in different locations. I think about 13 locations that we know of across the island, and then launch their siege against the invaders, against the colonizers, to liberate the space. But Bookman Dutty, in that ceremony of Wakaima, is credited with giving inspiration to the cause. Well, after this, he was assassinated. He didn't even get to see the victory of 1804. He didn't get to see the victory of Toussaint Louverture in 1801. He was assassinated almost immediately. But the revolution didn't stop, because this Congress across the island in 13 different locations established a line of succession among leaders so that if somebody was killed, another would be able to continue because there was a revolutionary plan in place. So we know of Toussaint Louverture as a key figure, as a general, a leader in this revolutionary period. But we also know that he was betrayed by Napoleon in 1801 after the Africans in Haiti successfully ended slavery on the island in 1801. And when he was betrayed and he was captured, and then before he was ferried off of the island by the French, he made note that you may get rid of me, that you may cut me down, but I'm only the trunk of the tree. Our roots run deep, and we are many. And what comes after me is much worse. And what came after him, in fact, was much worse. We remember Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who was the last general. He succeeded Toussaint Louverture. And he saw forward the independence of the nation, because Toussaint Louverture did not establish independence of Haiti. He just established a slavery-free state in 1801 and was willing to work with the French to be a state of the French Empire. Jean-Jacques Dessalines moved forward beyond that and said, well, not only do we not have slavery here anymore, not only do we have freedom of religion now, because Toussaint Louverture conceded to the Catholics, to the Roman Catholic Church, and said that the religion of the state will be Catholicism. Jean-Jacques Dessalines established the nation as having freedom of religion and continued the abolition of slavery and established independence in 1804. But something interesting, did not establish a republic or did not establish a nation, as it were, a nation state, but an empire of liberty in which all of these Africans who had different nationalities, there are dozens of nationalities that are recognized in Haiti at that time, all African and indigenous to the land. And upon establishing the empire, you then have these nationalities united under the banner of being Haitien or being Haitian, which is something that people did not have to naturalize themselves into, as we do have to do today through a period of either living there for 5 years and establishing residency or getting married or being born to a Haitian. It was something that people seeking freedom, regardless of their complexion, could come into. And once you come into that, then you're considered to be black. There's no difference in people because of their skin complexion. Once you're Haitian, once you're Haitian, you are Haitian, regardless of your nationality. And so we see this, and this is important because a lot of people talk about Haiti being the first, after the revolution, becoming the first black republic in the Western Hemisphere, which is true. But what happened at the point of victory was establishing this empire. And then it was different than anything else that we had seen at this point in our history because of everything that juxtaposed it was opposite to the liberty and the freedom of African people. And not just African people, but anybody seeking freedom from oppression. So these are important points, and you may want to jump in with any comments or questions as I go along, and please feel free, because I think a conversation really brings out really important historical points that otherwise we may not get exposed to. So if you do have anything that you'd like to ask or contribute, please feel free, and I'll be able to respond to those as we move forward in the history of the Haitian struggle.
Yeah, you know, I was just listening to your presentation, and one of the things came to mind in terms of Haiti is that Haiti made contributions to, in many areas, many aspects of life. And one of the things I was just thinking about, when you look at Western Hemisphere and Western history, they lack for you to think that in the Virginia colony, that was this European named Thomas Jefferson came up with this concept of give me liberty or give me death, and this whole concept of liberty. I think if you could speak just briefly a little bit to the whole concept, I think this, even from that quote, give me liberty or death, that sentiment and quote more so came out of Haiti first and foremost than from these so-called colonizers who traveled and created this so-called state of Virginia. I just would like to have your general response to that because before, you know, probably on your presentation, I know you may touch on Haiti's contribution and role plays towards understanding that liberation of Africans in Haiti cannot be separated from liberation from Africans in Central, South, and North American colonies. So anyway, you can just speak to that narrative, this question of liberty was not a foreign concept that came from European, but Haiti recognized that a long time ago in that struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that comment, because that's something that's really important, because the slogan, if you will, the motto of the nation, of the empire, was liberty or death, liberté ou la mort, which then that people, some people say, well, that came out of the French Revolution, 1789, and the Haitians just borrowed it. And there are so many things that the Haitians just borrowed from the French Revolution and implemented in Haiti. Well, while they definitely used the opportunity of the French Revolution to, as a point of being able to beat the French, because the French were torn, the European nations were torn at the point of that revolution. And so in 1789, as smart as they were in using their environment to their advantage in the atmosphere, they recognized that if the Europeans are at war, if the Europeans are weak in 1789, then we can make sure that we launch our Congress at that time in 1791 and launch our revolution and be successful. That's just smart. But understanding the use of liberté ou la mort is something that the Africans didn't just use colloquially. They literally did that, because there was no compromise between liberty and death. They weren't going to compromise with the Europeans. You see, when the Europeans used liberty or death, give me liberty or give me death, they didn't really mean that. They compromised in that. Whether you're looking at the French Revolution, whether you're looking at the American Revolution, no matter where you're looking at in regard to the Europeans, they compromised with those who that they were at war with. The Africans in IET, when they said liberty or death, they meant liberty or death, meaning they were going to fight to the last man, to the last woman. They were going to get their liberation. So there weren't going to be any more enslaved Africans in Haiti if the Africans lost that battle, because they were going to fight down to the last. Understand this. The ways in which the Africans fought this battle were just really unprecedented. For example, you had cannons on the island that the Europeans would use. Now, the Africans didn't have any sort of armor to defend themselves against cannonballs. So what they would do to stop the use of cannons by Europeans is put their own bodies in the cannons to make the cannons unusable, which, of course, was suicide. You had to have Africans willing to put their bodies in a cannon to block. So when the Europeans tried to use it, it malfunctioned. Some of the women would put their own children in the cannons because, of course, the children were smaller and they could fit in there. So clogging these cannons with their own lives and their own children to make sure that the Europeans were disarmed is something that the Europeans weren't doing in battle with each other. They were charging into these weapons to make them malfunction. And you had people forsaking their own families. There are songs that talk about, I don't have a mother, I don't have a father. Forward soldiers. These lyrics that they would sing to themselves so that they wouldn't look back and say, you know what, I can't die. I can't risk my life. I've got a mother and a father that I got to look after. Or, you know, I have relatives I have to bury. I can't move forward in this revolution. All of those things they were forsaken by these Africans for the sake of liberty, and not only for themselves and the island, but because they understood when they win here, it will send a ripple effect throughout the world to end enslavement of peoples. Period. And we saw that. You mentioned the impact on the colonies across the Americas. After the revolution, the successful revolution in Haiti, the immediate plan of the Empire of Liberty was to offer up resources any other nation, to any other peoples that wanted liberty. And we saw that happen with the Bolivarian Revolution in South America, where Simon Bolivar, who was launching his own revolution to free the spaces in South America from colonialism and was being beaten, He went to the shores of the nation of Haiti, and he found aid there, not only in soldiers, but also in resources to be able to launch a successful revolution in South America. But the condition of that aid given to him was that not only that he liberate these spaces from colonialism so that they can be independent, but that he abolish slavery there. And so if it weren't for Haiti, there would be no Venezuela. There would be no Bolivia. There would be no Colombia. And so these things that Africans did for themselves benefited the world. You have, for example, Polish people who were there and were fighting because they were oppressed, and they were fighting on behalf of the Africans in Haiti. Once the independence happened, they were immediately brought in as Haitians. They weren't enemies simply because they had white or pale skin. They were allies because they sought liberty for themselves and for other people, and they sacrificed their lives for themselves and for other people. And the condition of the nation was such that it embraced brothers and sisters in struggle, no matter what their complexion. And I think that's a very important point in history and understanding what it is that African people were willing to do that these European nations and these European empires were unwilling to do, even for their brother and sister nations in Europe. And so we see that struggle continue on, in that even let's bring it home here where we happen to live. We know that the Civil War led to the abolishment of enslavement, or at least the reclassification of it, with the amendment that sees that there's an exception to the rule for those they deem are criminal. But at any rate, the Civil War did lead to that abolishment of chattel slavery, open plantation chattel slavery, and the end of the enslavement of Africans that were trafficked from Africa to the United States. What we don't realize in a lot of cases is that Haiti, even though it had been weakened because of imperialist and American aggression toward this now independent African nation, it still had great influence on the world. And at the time of the Civil War, or before it started, we had an empire or an emperor in Haiti, which was the last emperor and the last empress, Emperor Faustine I and his wife, Empress Adelina. This emperor had sent agents, just as emperors had before and kings and presidents had before, agents across the continent, across the landmass, to foment revolution. The United States, actually, the federal government was complaining about the Emperor Faustine sending agents to Cuba, for example, and Puerto Rico, for example, to foment revolution there so that they could be independent and free of enslavement. And you had people as far east in the Caribbean as St. Lucia. These people were still enslaved. These Africans were still enslaved, but they heard about the emperor in Haiti, and they were cheering for Emperor Suluk, Sin Suluk. And they were fomenting revolution in these places. He also did so in the United States. And so at the risk, when, you know, this is one of the things that Lincoln, we don't really credit, that Lincoln was considering. It's like, if we don't have our own decision on this slavery question, then the Empire of Haiti will make a decision for us. And if they impact these Africans and get them on their side, then we won't be able to get them on our side, on the Union side. So Lincoln had a choice. He said, okay, either we get the Africans by declaring an Emancipation Proclamation, we get these Africans on the Union side, or we're going to have Africans on the Haitian side fighting against the Union and the Confederacy, and the Confederacy, of course, fighting against the Union, and there's a chance that the Union and the Confederacy could lose to the Haitians, which would transform the history of this landmass dramatically. So Lincoln made a very strategic move and figured out how to get the Africans on the Union side before we decided to side with ourselves and real liberty in Haiti. So these are things that we don't get to see in history books, the impact of Haiti even on the Civil War of the United States of America. and how it continues to impact our people in the 21st century through modern movements and struggles. It's a very important thing, and so, you know, I really appreciate your question, your comment on that liberty or death, because it really informs us in how the Africans in IET have moved over the decades and over the centuries.
Let me get you to speak a little bit on the subject of the importance of culture as we look at Haiti. You know, the West, you know, they often take African culture and demean it and devalue it. Can you just give us a brief history of what is Van Du? I don't know if I've been correctly pronouncing it right, but to the best of my ability, when you talk about Van Du, how the Haitians define it and see it and use it as a tool to elevate their people to even today to continue to struggle against any kind of form of domination.
That's one of the most important aspects, because when you look at Boakaima, that was a cultural phenomenon that happened at Congress of 1791, where Africans got together and recognized their respective cultures nationally and unified that culture on one front. And people call it a voodoo ceremony. It was a voodoo ceremony. Voodoo means spirit, and that was the spirit of revolution that the Africans were coming together to bring according to their own culture, to say, this is how we're going to do this, and this is how we're going to win. And Africans have used their own culture in IET as a weapon and as a balm for themselves, but a weapon against those who would seek to oppress them. And that's why you see IET, unlike other places that have independence now, but IET continues to struggle against oppression. Unlike some places, I don't want to name any other nations that are black-led, but we can just look and compare in the Caribbean, where the nations that don't have lost their predominantly African character tend to struggle less against oppression from Europeans, because they seek to emulate Europeans as opposed to defeat them on the whatever political spectrum we tend to be in. And so this culture has had to be demonized by Europeans. We saw that demonized in the 20th century, very, very much so by the United States after their invasion in 1915. And that's where we get in popular media the images of zombies. We didn't have that in popular media before the Europeans, the Americans invaded IET. That's how they demonized IET. Said, oh, they have all this witchcraft over there, and they're evil. And if you deal with them, then they're going to turn you into zombies, and they're backwards, and their culture is so inhuman and inhumane. But, you know, those aren't true. A lot of those stories are untrue. They're just made up by Hollywood. And so we have to really spend time and understand that the culture, the spirit of revolution, the voodoo, is something that we all have access to. It's something that is ancestral for African people. And once we embrace that, we can do whatever it is that we choose to do as African people in the world and move forward how we see fit. The history of IET shows us that. The culture of IET informs us and educates us in that way, and it's something that we should all spend time learning and appreciating.
You know, Brother Kwaku, you talk about Haiti's role and our willingness to understand that the struggle of oppression of African people throughout the world, particularly around this whole question around the struggle of African people coming to the West, is of oneness. Can you just give us an up-to-date version of terms of their continued battle against the various forms of oppression, whether it be trying to be colonized by the French or the British, or now we can see the Americans and we can see the Canadians. We can see these new set of forces that are playing a role to trying to dominate and dictate their well-being, such as the behavior and role of the Clinton Foundations and the politicians, how they are controlling them politically and economically to keep them from being an independent nation. Can you talk about that phenomenon? Because many people don't understand the relationship between the struggle and oppression that they have today or facing today it directly related to the same forces that Africans in this country and other parts of the world are dealing with when it comes to the influence of power of U.S. imperialism led by the U.S., Canada, and the rest of the Western nations.
Yes, absolutely. You know, what Haiti is dealing with today, and people look at Haiti because of, again, of media propaganda as just this poor nation that needs the help of charitable individuals from around the world. But people don't realize that the United States, as you mentioned, Canada, but primarily the United States has led the way in colonizing IET since 1915. And IET is still a colony of the United States. The way that the United States colonizes is a bit different than its predecessors, like the empires before it of Britain and France and Spain. The way that the United States colonizes is it allows its colony to maintain the semblance of independence. So, for example, they'll still have their own flag. They'll still have a constitution and a head of state and all these things. But they come in and they rewrite. So what happened in 1915 when the United States Marines invaded and occupied IET was they removed the head of state that was in place. They put a new head of state. They rewrote the constitution under that head of state. And they put these provisions under what was called the U.S. Haiti Convention of 1915, where Haiti would have to seek approval from the United States for its international relations actions. Haiti's finances would be under the control of the United States. And we see that much in that the United States Marines took the gold, the solid gold that was in IET, brought it to Fort Knox to ensure the loan, or not the loan, I should say, but the debt that Haiti had remaining to France. The Citibank of New York purchased that. And so because Citibank was in the United States, a corporation of the United States, the Marines were used to secure that. And then they took their gold bars to secure that debt, which wasn't paid until 1947. So we see these things. And, of course, also one of the provisions of that convention was that the United States had the right to intervene militarily in IET as it saw fit. And so that helps us understand how it is and why it is the United States would send in troops during the coups of the 1990s and the 2000s. With President Aristide, just to swoop in with the military. They don't do that in most nations of the world whenever there is some political dispute. They don't just send in their military to pick up a head of state or to intervene. They do it in IET because this convention is still on the books and still in effect. And they can come in and decide, well, this is who the head of state will be, as they did after the earthquake in 2010. And they did again in 2016 after the issues with the election that was supposed to have happened in 2015. And so until Haitians, until African people in IET are able to do what the Cubans did in their revolution under the leadership of Fidel Castro, those things will continue. And I compare it to the revolution of Cuba because the United States did the same thing to Cuba after they got their independence. The United States did the exact same thing as coming in, rewriting the Constitution, and creating this international provision to say the United States has the right to intervene militarily whenever it sees fit, to control the financial affairs and the international relations affairs of independent Cuba. And that was on the books and in play until Fidel Castro and his revolutionaries took over the government and ended that. And that is why, of course, the United States has had Cuba under sanctions since then, because they want that colony back. They want that situation back. And so we recognize, and we need African people in Haiti to recognize that parallel, so that they'll see that the kinds of struggle that has been happening is just a prelude. It has to just be a prelude to the sort of revolution that the Cubans led under Fidel Castro in order to end that paradigm of neocolonialism that the United States is so has done so well at IET and other places in Latin America. That is the model. That's the paradigm for success. The Haitians have done it before in the 19th century. And so we understand that the Africans there can do it again in the 21st century, but it has to be something that is led there by the Africans there, but also includes Africans, just as the Cuban Revolution included revolutionaries that were not born in Cuba. The next phase of this Haitian Revolution to liberate itself from U.S. colonization must include Africans who were not born in Haiti. And so that's why I am honored to be an African who was not born in Haiti, but am connected to revolutionaries there. And hopefully one day we'll see forward revolutionary liberation of Haiti once again in the 21st century.
You're listening to MPH Radio. We're talking with Brother Kweku Lumumba. We are receiving our story of the history and the struggle of Haiti. We're going to take a station break with music with a message, and when we come back, we will continue this discussion, because Haiti has had a profound impact in the past as well as the present on African people globally. So we must understand this history and this connection. This is one of the many missing pages that we must fill in. We'll be right back. This is MPH Radio.
Thank you.
That's right. Learning to love yourself, love your people, and love humanity is the greatest love of all. We welcome you back to MPH Radio, Part 2, Telling Our Stories. Freedom is coming. Before we go back and have a dialogue with Brother Kweku Lumumu on the story and the history of Haiti and struggles, we'd like to just maybe take this time, just remind our listening audience that, yes, it's important to, for us to travel and visit our people and learn from our people. And one of the things we're doing for the first time this year with Missing Pages of History is from filling a bucket list and a dream of one of our co-founders, Mr. Emmanuel Joyner. We will be organizing, or we are organizing, a African delegation and people of goodwill to come and visit and see Cuba for yourself. You just heard Brother Kweku talk about the history and importance of Cuba and its relation to African people. We'd like to invite you, in honor of one of our co-founders, Emmanuel D. Joyner, and show our respect and love for the Cuban people and what they are doing for humanity, is come to travel with us from July the 23rd to July the 31st, 2022. We're going to be spending a whole week in Cuba, traveling to Guantanamo, Santiago, and its capital, Havana. Leaving for Cancun, Mexico. It's a trip in your lifetime. We said we must make investment in our people. When we talk about teaching our youth, this would be an excellent chance to bring our youth, but in this case, we would recommend at this particular trip, they must be at least 18 or older to come and show their support and show their understanding and their love of when someone have principally done things to try to make your life better. That at the very minimum we can do is not to be ungrateful and thank them for it. So we ask all of those who listen to this program, if you'd like to join our delegation, please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com or email the African Awareness Association 2@gmail.com and let us know that you would like to join this delegation. This is an investment, a human investment of your lifetime. Forgive the fact we have just made a little announcement. And for those who may like to support us who can't go, yes, we take all loving gifts by emailing to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27762, P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. So that's one of our important announcements for today. It's tied directly into this question of telling our stories. And we now will go back to our brother, Kweku, and our co-host, Brother Alex. He may have some questions or comments he'd like to make at this point in time to Brother Kweku. Brother Alex, we now bring you in. The mic is yours. Welcome to MPH Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. And for our guest, because I've been sitting here just, mulling over everything he said, and it's just been amazing. I'm learning so much history. I feel like I'm in class somewhere. But that's the most important thing, that we're being taught something here today. And I pray that everyone takes the show again and listen to it and listen to this rich history of an independent black nation founded on the idea that they were going to be free at all costs. Nothing was going to stand in their way. They had been indentured servants. They had been saying master for many years. And now they had thrown that cloak of oppression off their shoulders and had moved forth and had started out on a venture. And then all of a sudden you had colonial powers that were still trying to keep them oppressed even after their independence. But one thing that I've always wondered, because I may be right, I may be wrong, so I need to be corrected here. But I know some of the island was French. The other half was maybe Spanish and everything else, English or whatever, Portuguese. But between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, you shared an island. And I think it maybe at one point in history, it was one country, and then it separated again. But can you give me some history there, our host, about the separation of the two different countries? Because it seems like both of them had a different idea, where Haiti wanted to be that independent nation, and it seems like the Dominican Republic still wanted to be a stepchild or be up under someone else forever. So clear me up on those facts, and I would appreciate that.
That's a great comment and question on that, because when the Africans established the Empire of Haiti, and people can go back to the Constitution of the Empire of 1805 and see what land was included in this empire, we'll quickly see that the entire island and smaller land masses, little islands off of the coast of Haiti, were included in the empire. So you're correct. It was the entire landmass, the entire island, that was considered to be independent, and Haiti. Now, unfortunately, you have our African brothers and sisters who give a great example of us not having to wait to move into leadership of statecraft. Immediately out of enslavement, we'd risen to be heads of state. But there were also, like you said, different visions of what sort of state they wanted to have. Even in Haiti, the western portion of the island that we look at today as being Haiti, the emperor of Haiti, once this whole island was established as free in Haiti, he was assassinated 2 years after. He was assassinated in 1806, betrayed by some of his allies, some of his comrades, the generals. And then they established the Republic in the South, and a kingdom was established in the North. Now, what has happened with this Republic in the South is that you had Africans who fought, who were comrades at arms for the liberation of the space, yet they had a dual allegiance. They were aligned with African independence, but they were also aligned with the European fathers. They were mixed, not just genealogically, but psychologically. They were mixed up. And so when they wanted to have this republic that respected the rule of the European empires, but they just wanted to also have their freedom, and they didn't appreciate that they couldn't have both, like Jean-Jacques Dessalines knew and appreciated. So when you have an Alexandre Pétion, for example, who establishes the republic in the South, that's when you begin to have this discussion between the Republic of Haiti, which is only a portion of the island. It's really the southwestern portion of the island at this time, and the Empire of France, to say, look, we want you to recognize us as a free and independent nation, and we're willing to pay for it. France said no to Pétion. And then his successor, Boyer, President Boyer, did the same thing and said, look, we want you to recognize us as a free and independent republic. So we're willing to pay for it. They were willing to pay 15 million francs. France said no at first to Pétion. And then when Boyer approached the Emperor of France again to say, look, we'll pay you 15 million francs. He said, no, you're going to pay us 150 million francs. And if you don't, we're going to invade the island. And so that's the point in which we see this debt of freedom, this freedom debt onto Haiti, which they were paying from that point until 1947. So it's not simply a matter of the French coming to Haiti with their guns and saying, pay us or else. It was a betrayal of the African mind to this duality and saying we're African and free, but we also want to be European and recognized by these Europeans. So we'll pay for it. And so in that, you have the Spanish, as you mentioned, who are also defeated in this Haitian Revolution and want to reclaim their space. And so they take advantage of the divisions that had already taken place in Haiti after the successful revolution so that they can reclaim the eastern portion of the nation or of the island. And although there were attempts by the Haitian revolutionaries to maintain control of this space, it was never really solidified because you figure immediately, almost immediately after independence, the emperor is assassinated. So 2 years. So there's a lot of things that didn't get a chance to solidify in Haiti as far as the governance structure over this landmass. So a lot of things were open for grabs and up for grabs by whoever could do it. And unfortunately, the Spanish were able to do it. There were continued attempts even through the mid-1800s to reclaim this space for Haiti. I mentioned Emperor Faustin Salouk. He tried multiple times to do it. He sent in troops multiple times to retake this portion of the island and was unsuccessful. And so we see how this portion of the island, even though it gained independence and a proxy relationship with Spain, it still saw itself. It's a continued legacy of this duality of psychology to say, we're free, we want to be independent, but we also want to be recognized and accepted by our European fathers, which happened to be Spain in this case for a lot of people, because we see even into the 20th century, the wanting to whiten up Dominican Republic, because before the 20th century, before the 1930s, the people looked the same. It was an African people. It's just that they had this allegiance to their European forefathers in Dominican Republic by virtue of the Spanish influence. But in the 1930s, we see a President Trujillo who takes it to the next level and says, we are going to invite Europeans in so that they can have sex and produce children with the darker complexion Dominicans, and so that we can then create this light skin caste. And that's exactly what he did. He was so demented about it that he would even paint his face white. I mean, he might be the first case in African history of white face. We talk about blackface a lot among Europeans, but he would powder his face as a black man so that he would look white. That's how bad the psychology was. And it created in this society now, he magnified it by creating a new caste of European-born Dominicans that looked down on darker complexion people, whether they were born in Haiti or born on the Dominican side. And so that creates a situation where you have hyper-colorism on the island, and you have people who feel like because they're a lighter complexion, they're better, and they associate that with being Dominican, even though they're related by blood to the Haitians. And so it's a problem, one of the struggles that is ongoing in the 21st century to overcome the consequences of this colorism, overcome the consequences of this dual or competing psychology of being African and European at the same time, wanting to be a free African and also be accepted by colonizing Europeans at the same time. And that's the dynamic that we see playing out in disputes and border disputes between the Dominican Republic and their brothers and sisters on the western portion in Haiti.
You know, the response, Brother Alex, before we go to our next caller?
Yes, I think he answered it well, and now I'm a whole lot more clear. And I'm so glad that you brought up about the differences in the color ratio between the Haitians and the Dominicans, because it seemed like it was a huge problem for quite a few years, and the two nations could not get along, but yet and still they both had African ancestry. So it befuddled me years ago in school when I learned it, because, you know, how could these people not get along on the same album, and they took two different directions about independent laws and governing themselves, and even how their relationship was, you know, with other European countries and other Caribbean countries that they could easily trade with and do different things. And it was astonishing that they could not work together on the island themselves, and it seemed like it just spread out to Puerto Rico and everywhere else, to Costa Rica and everywhere. Everybody was engaged, but yet still, again, you had common African ancestry. So he answered it greatly, and I appreciate it.
Next, we are going to do caller 4298. If caller 4298, do you have any comment or questions for our guest today?
Yeah, I'm just good at listening and learning. It's been a very enjoyable, very intellectually stimulating show, and I appreciate it. I think the contradictions between Haiti and Dominican Republic should be resolved as contradictions among the people, and that's going to take some doing, I guess. Anyway, I'm just continue to listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Brother Kwaku, in your closing remarks, we would like for you to address a couple issues. One, speak to the African community outside of Haiti on why it's important for us to see this as one struggle, and how can we help our brothers and sisters in Haiti?
Well, it's important for us to see this struggle in IET as our struggle, no matter where we happen to be born as African people, because when we look at the geopolitics of this struggle in the 21st century, we're looking at IET once again being able to be the fulcrum in which we can have true liberation in the Americas or continue with this neocolonial pattern. And I say that because we look at where the United States sits in relation to what it considers its backyard, the Caribbean and South America, or the Caribbean and Latin America. And while Cuba has really thrown a wrench in the plan of the United States to maintain a sort of neocolonial control over these spaces, IET is unique compared to Cuba in that it is undeniably African. We can look at Cuba and people can be forgiven if they don't realize how African Cuba is in its makeup. Because when they see Cuba or they see depictions of Cubans on TV, they only see light complexion people, in spite of the fact that the Cuban people are an African people. But when you look at IET, there's no hiding the African character, even down to the culture. I mean, you can look at the people and you can see that these are an African people. You can look at the culture and you can say this is African culture. The foods, you can look at the foods and you had the same foods in different regions of IET that you find today in different regions of Africa, unchanged. The name may be different because the language is different, but the actual substance of it. If you're looking for fufu, for example, from Nigeria, you can find fufu in IET, unchanged, made the same way and used and eaten the same way. If you're looking for any sort of thing as far as gumbo, for example, gumbo, which is called, which is an African word for okra, you find that same word being used for okra in IET. So the food ways, the mores and the folk ways, all these things are African, undeniably. The people and their appearance, undeniably African. Even parts of the language as we retained in Creole are still African terms. If this space is truly liberated from this neocolonialism, then it serves to inspire other African people throughout the hemisphere, because they don't have to say, well, we're looking at Cuba, but these are a bunch of white people who led a revolution. We're looking at Venezuela, but these are a bunch of white people, even though this is not true, but this is just what people see. But when IET does it, then the African people will say, these are African people leading the charge of revolution against neocolonialism and oppression and exploitation in the Americas. And so the African people in Mexico will be able to rise up. The African people in Bolivia will be able to rise up. The African people that are left in Argentina and Chile will be able to rise up. And, of course, all across the Caribbean will be able to say, this is our opportunity, this is our chance. And we don't want to forget our African brothers and sisters, those of us who live in the belly of the United States of America, in the belly of Canada, will be able to rise up and say, this is our opportunity. These are our people. This is our revolution. We can do it too. In the same way that people around the world were inspired by the way in which African people stood up in the United States after the George Floyd assassination. That same way of inspiration, when African people see other African people rising up, African people around the world rise up. They did it after the Haitian Revolution, and when Haiti rises up again, we'll do it again. So it's really important for us to transform the exploitative relationship that we've had with the power structure in the Americas for so long. It's important that Haiti is successful in its struggle in the 21st century.
And, brother, how can people would like to invite you to their community, support your organization? How can they contact you and your organization and become a support base?
Well, first off, anybody who has internet access, we invite you to go to the website. You can access COSA's website via the URL www.kossa.com. That's kossa.com. And then that way you can engage with the External Relations Office through the website. Or if you prefer to call and you're able to call the a U.S. line, you can call 404-884-6638. Once again, the External Relations Office number is 404-884-6638. And then we can move forward as far as either you being interested in working with COSA or traveling to IET or just inviting a representative of COSA to a particular event.
And on that note, Brother Kweku Lumumba, we'd like to thank you for being our special guest today and helping us to fill in one of our many, many millions of pages of missing pages of history. Thank you very much.
And thank you. I really appreciate this and look forward to more opportunities.
Thank you. All right, listen, audience, this is Simpage Radio. We have just completed one of our pages, missing pages of history, as we gave you a perspective of the history of the struggle of Haiti. And we will continue this. This is not going to be the first nor the last, but there's so much we can learn from Haiti and its history and struggle. But at this particular time, we'll make our transition to, we're going to have a message from the community by Alex. Then we're going to have the inspiring message of inspiration for our minister, from our dear Sister Hunt, Mary Hunt, coming up shortly after we return from our music with a message. This is MPH Radio.
Hey!
I want to say, if they don't really care about us, we do. We care about you at MPH Radio, Missing Pages of History. But we understand if we're going to move forward, we must do this collectively. So we are encouraging all people who would like to help build this institution become part of this network. Please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. If you want to show your financial love and gifts, you can send it to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. Where is there unity, there is progress. So let's unite. We're dealing with part two, telling our stories. Freedom is coming. Again, we'd like to thank Brother Kweku Mamumu for his excellent presentation on the history and struggle of Haiti. We would like to thank all those who have been a part of this production and those who have allowed this particular program to come in their homes. We thank you and ask you to help us build our audience by spreading the word. This program comes on a biweekly basis every other Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. You can join us Eastern Time. So on that note, we're going through our final transition where we have a special message from the community by Brother Alex Joyner, and then it will be followed by words of inspiration from our minister, Sister Mary Hunt. So Brother Alex, what is your message to the community?
Well, first of all, I would like to thank Susie again for providing us with her information, because it's history that all of us need to know about. Because if we don't know about our history, how are we going to challenge the fate of our future? I'm coming to you today from Georgia. I've been in South Carolina the past week and finally on my way home, hopefully tomorrow. And I want to tell the people of South Carolina, thank you. Columbia, thank you. Buford, thank you. You made my welcome and my presence wonderful. To the people of Georgia, you have been outstanding, without a doubt. This is Black History Month, and if you want to know Black history, you come to Georgia. I'll tell you that. I enjoyed myself at the King Center, Ebenezer Church, and at the Entombment. And the Park Bookstore was most, and the members of Ebenezer Baptist Church who run the store there, wonderful. I truly thank you for everything. But as we go about life, and there are a few things in life that make a difference and should make a difference. And one of those things that should make a difference in everybody's life is dinner time. Dinner time was especially a great moment for me because I enjoyed it. But there was something later that television embarked on, and there was a movie that came out, and it was called Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So as a child, I was taught in my home how important dinner time was. It was family time. My father would sit down at the table after a long, hard day at work, and he sought the sanctuary of a good meal. My mother took pride in the meals she prepared for us, and they were always delicious. Mom's meal always seemed to be the best. My older brothers and sisters sometimes prepared dishes that they shared recipes too, or they had meals from over at my big mama's house or other relatives or friends. The family's efforts to provide an unforgettable meal still last in my memory today. Holiday dinners and birthdays meant you got even more special dishes and you could eat more than your stomach could hold. The food was good and made me happy as I ate. I especially enjoyed the ham, turkey, barbecue, steak, meatloaf, pork chops, fish, or hot fried chicken as a main course. Then we had fresh salad, corn, field peas, spring beans, collards, turnip greens, butter beans, baked beans, grape northern beans, or white potatoes. The sweet potato pie, apple or cherry, cakes of all kinds, along with a baked banana pudding my father made was a feast for royalty. Did I forget the homemade ice cream we churned by hand? Yes, we ate well as children because we had parents who loved and did all they could to make simple meals a dinner to always remember. If you ever came to a dinner at the Joiners, you left with your heart filled with love, your stomach filled with food, and your hands full of leftovers to enjoy later. Dinner time was a wonderful time for my parents out. I enjoyed sitting down with my family with a blessed meal before us to discuss things such as how well we were doing in school, daily politics, why we had to be our best, which lady had a new baby, who got married, and who passed away in the family or neighborhood. It was our information network of learning to adjust to a society that was one-sided. Even as a child, I knew it was a challenge to succeed at my personal best. Just like the meal spread out before me, I knew I had to bring something special to the table of life to be accepted as an equal in America. So guess who's coming to dinner? Many years ago, I remember sitting down at dinner and asking my father what he thought of the movie, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I remember him saying it would change some white people's minds and they would be more understanding. But it would inflame others with the hate he had seen all his life, and they would do all they could to destroy the black man and his family in America. I remember reading magazines and newspaper stories that declared a race war would start if the movie was released. I feared for the life of the actor, Mr. Sidney Poitier, if he ever visited the South. The warning signs were plain and simple. He would be put to death. The film was one of the few that depicted an interracial marriage announcement in a positive light. Historically, interracial marriage had been illegal in many states. Many black men had been severely injured for life or lynched without a trial in the day or night to send a message to all black Americans that it would not be tolerated anywhere, north, south, east, or west. At the time of the film, interracial marriage was illegal in 17 states. Then in 1967, just months before the film was released, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled interracial marriage was legal in all states. The film was the final on-screen pairing of Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn as the father and mother of the white bride, Katharine Parker. Spencer Tracy would die 17 days later after filming his role, and Katharine Hepburn never saw the completed film due to her emotional ties to Tracy. On the 50th anniversary of the movie's release, it was selected for preservation in the U.S. National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. There could only have been one actor who could have played Dr. John Wade Prince, a 37-year-old black widower, and it could only have been Sidney Poitier. Sidney Poitier was born February 20, 1927, in Miami, Florida, to the visiting parents from the Bahamas. He came back to Miami when he was 15 and then went to New York a year later to join the African Negro Theater. He had won Academy Awards and Golden Globe Awards before this role. This role added to his list of great accomplishments as the best foreign performer. Isabel Sanford, long-running TV show The Jeffersons, played Tilly, the maid, and she responded to the question, guess who's coming to dinner now? with the sarcastic one line. The Reverend Martin Luther King, the remark was moved in 1960 due to the assassination of Dr. King, but restored in 1969, but not in all movie format. Poitier's character had to be a reflection of the man he was. To play the part, it took a man who would be accepted by white and black Americans. He had to be perfect by white standards. He had to be cool and in control by black standards. For blacks could label him a sellout by his actions in the movie. His leaving money in the open container when he made the long-distance call on his future father-in-law's death meant he was paying his way and not leaving the debt to anyone. His credential as a doctor meant that he would be financially secure. His statement of love for his soon-to-be wife meant he accepted the problems and hate they would encounter throughout life. My favorite part was when they stopped at a club to get drinks on the way to get John's parents, and the singer sang The Glory of Love, a 1936 hit from Benny Goodman. As a writer, I have found that it's always been about the words written and spoken eloquently by an actor or singer. All the rest is just gibberish and makes no sense. I still recall the movie and the black man who was the youngest of seven children, whose father owned a farm on Cat Island and drove a taxicab. Young Sidney had lied about his age and joined the U.S. Army. After the Army, he joined the American Negro Theater. Being tone deaf, he couldn't sing like other black performers, so he crafted his speaking line and acting skill. His reviews as an actor were written as being noble, rich, intelligent, handsome, magnificent, and challenged and changed the stereotypes of only being a singer, comic, or buffoonery role of a black actor. Poitier looked for roles to uplift and provide dignity to his race. He was knighted by the Queen and received numerous acting awards as he stood tall with the best of the best. His movies are too numerous to name, but you will truly enjoy every character he played. Sir Sidney Poitier, I thank you for being the eloquent man you were, a king in your own right. You sat at the table of the wealthy and powerful, and that did not change you. You gave back to the black community in so many ways. As the British school kid saying praises to you in the movie, to sir with love. I do the same with respect and honor in my words. Mr. Sidney Poitier, you have given us a vast selection of outstanding movies to enjoy for eternity. And I thank you for these minutes.
And we thank you, Brother Alex, for your message to the community. And we'd like to make a quick note of one of our announcements that we didn't share with the listeners earlier, but we'd like to do this now. Again, we'd like to remind you, and this would be a good African History Month gift. We'd like to inform our listening audience and supporters to purchase the two-volume book set by Pan-African Roots with the producer, with the writer, Brother Bob Brown. There are two excellent books. So if you're talking about history and what took place in the past, and so we can better understand our present, he has two books you can purchase, two volumes, one and two, titled We Demand the Full Disclosure and Dignitization of All Slavery Era Rappers. If you haven't made your purchase, please go to the website, www.a-a-prp-gc.org. Make that contribution, support that writer, and it's another source of knowledge where we can learn more about history and move our people forward. We also like to let our listening audience know that because of the nature of the pandemic, We still have our activities on hold, but we will be coming to you on a weekly basis on this radio program. Our next program will be the 12th of March at 1 p.m. So please share the word that we'll be on the 12th at 1 p.m. And like always, we will continue to move forward ever and backwards never. So in closing out this program today, in terms of leaving you with some words of inspiration, we will bring to you our minister. That's right. We say our minister of inspiration, Sister Mary Hunt. She has some words for you. Sister Mary, welcome to MPH Radio.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Thank you very much. The Hill We Climb by Amanda Gorman. When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace, and the norms and notions of what just is isn't always justice. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother, can dream of becoming president only to find herself reciting for one. And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge a union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. So we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first. We must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true, that even as we grieved, we grew. Even as we hurt, we hoped. And even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together victoriously, not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one should make them afraid. If we're to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but all of the bridges that we've already made. That is the promise to glade, the hill that we climb, and only we dare it, because being American, it's more than a pride we inherit. It's the past that we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it, that would destroy our country if I meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can periodically be delayed, but it can never be permanently defeated. In this truth, in this faith, we trust. But while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. This is the era of just redemption. We feared in its inception. We did not feel prepared to be the heirs of such a terrifying hour. But within it, we found the power to author a new chapter, to offer hope and laughter to ourselves. So while once we asked, how can we possibly prevail over catastrophe, now we assert how could catastrophe possibly prevail over us. We will not march back to what was moved, to what shall be, a country that is bruised, but whole, benevolent, but bold, fierce, and free. We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation, because we know our inaction will be the inheritance of the next generation. Our blunders become their burden. But one thing is certain, if we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and it changes our children's birthright. So leave us behind a country better than the one we left. With every breath from my bronze pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the golden hills of the west. We will rise from the windswept northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked south. We will rebuild, reconcile, and we will recover in every nook of our nation and every corner our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When the day comes, we will step out of the shade of flame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms, and we free for it. But there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it. If only we're brave enough to be it. Thank you.
And you've been listening to Minister Mary Hunt, Words of Inspiration, and we, Mississippi of History, like to thank you for allowing us to come into your home this evening and to help us fill in our one of many missing pages of history. We'll see you on the 12th of March. Spread the word, and let's continue to serve our underserved communities. Remember, we are here for all of them. This has been MPH Radio.
Let's talk about our part. My heart touch your heart. Let's talk about love each other, sister, we are here. We are here for all of us. We are here for all of us. That's why we are here. Why we are here.
While we are here, while we are here.